Okay, welcome back to our final session. This is a lung cancer review. My name is Dr. Justin Favero, oncology specialist of Charlotte. I'd like to introduce our panelists, Dr. Abibi Dogogo-Jack from Mass General, and then Dr. Stephen Liu from Georgetown. We'll get started with our panel discussion.
Excellent. I think I have the first questions. And so the first few questions pertain to EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And I'm Abibi Dogogo-Jack, as mentioned. And so the first question is, how do you generally approach therapeutic selection for patients with EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer who have progressed on frontline osimertinib? And then add on to that is, do you believe that patritumab deruxtecan, or HER3-DXd, and or amivantamab lazertinib will play a role in this setting in the near future? So to tackle the first component of the question. So I think of a couple of key questions when presented with this situation. One, I want to know the extent of progression. Is it unifocal? Is it just in one site? Is there an opportunity for a local therapy, radiation, cryoablation, and continuing osimertinib beyond progression, recognizing that we don't have kind of an infinite number of therapies? I also want to know if they're progressing intracranially or extracranially. If they're progressing only extracranially, there might be an opportunity to continue osimertinib as well. And again, if intracranial, we may be able to use local therapies. I really want to know, what is the molecular kind of mechanism driving resistance here? And to answer this question, we have both tissue and plasma to reach for. But I present kind of this pie chart from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Group. This is almost 100 biopsies post-progression on osimertinib in the first-line setting to highlight a couple of key points. One, there are many, many different alterations that can arise after osimertinib. Two, we see a lot of histologic transformation. I guess I should qualify that. We see 15% of patients with histologic transformation. And then we also see things like MET amplification that might be harder to identify with plasma testing. And so I do tend to prioritize a tissue biopsy if I can, recognizing this is not feasible with everyone. I do pursue plasma as well. Things that might sway me towards a tissue biopsy is if they have very aggressive fulminant progression, I worry about small cell transformation. That's something that's difficult to tease out with a liquid biopsy. And if they're quite symptomatic, this is a different thing for me. I'm pushed for time, right? So I think a liquid biopsy, I might do that instead. And all of this kind of culminates with the next question, right? What are my next line treatment options? So chemo is an option, but I'm looking to tailor therapy to what I see as a driver of resistance, because we have at least retrospective data suggesting that patients do better when you tailor the therapy. And so this might be a clinical trial, or it might be an off-label combination therapy. And so for the second question, I think this goes to the pie chart that we saw, where we saw diverse molecular alterations at resistance to osimertinib, suggesting that we really need some sort of therapies that can have broad activity. And so enter these antibody-based therapies. The first one is amivantamab. This is an EGFR MET bispecific therapy, and we're looking at it in combination with lazertinib, which is a third-generation EGFR TKI that's akin to osimertinib. In various settings, in patients who have received osimertinib plus or minus chemotherapy, the response rate is about 20 to 30%, median PFS around 5 months. And then I do think that we've seen a little bit of enrichment of response among patients with EGFR and MET-driven resistance, but it does seem like an efficacious therapy. Another drug that you might be familiar with is patritumab deruxtecan. This is an ADC, or antibody drug conjugate, targeting HER3, which is overexpressed in the majority of EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancers. Here we also saw encouraging activity, response rate 40%, median PFS around 8 months. And importantly, what you see in those tables under, the grid under the waterfall plot is that there's broad activity across diverse resistance mechanisms. So to answer the question, I think these therapies have staying power. The question is whether or not patritumab will be as monotherapy or in combination with something else. And so stay tuned for those studies. And so turning towards a different EGFR mutant subset, as the second question, in which line of treatment do you administer targeted therapy to your patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer with EGFR exon 20 insertions? And how do you select between the available therapies? And so that is amivantamab and mobocertinib. And so I think we're fortunate. It's been for years where we've thought about kind of exon 20 insertions as almost stepsister, right? There's not a therapy. We can't repurpose our existing therapies. And now we're in a unique situation where we have not one, but two therapies. They're a bit different. And so to me, it's important that we identify these. I just wanted to briefly point out that PCR misses 50% of these. So NGS is the best strategy for this. But to walk us through the two therapies, amivantamab, we talked about, is an EGFR MET bispecific therapy. It's an infusional therapy. Response rate is about 40%. Median PFS PFS around 8 months, whereas we don't have head-to-head data, but mobocertinib is an oral therapy. Response rate is about 28%, and median PFS is quite comparable to amivantamab. But they also have differences as far as the toxicity profile. So amivantamab, two-thirds of patients get infusion reactions. They're typically self-limited. They happen with the first infusion for most patients. And then we also see EGFR and MET-related toxicities, mostly grade 1 and grade 2. The toxicities with mobocertinib are accentuated or kind of, accentuated EGFR toxicities. Diarrhea in 90% of patients, 1 in 5, it's a grade 3 diarrhea. We also see paronychia and some cardiac toxicities. So in my clinic, I think they're both great options to have, but I do tend to start with amivantamab just with the higher response rate, and I think that the predictable toxicity with that infusional reaction and otherwise grade 1 to 2 other toxicities.
So we'll go to Justin in a second for his questions, but first maybe just to get Stephen's view on this. How do you approach patients who are progressing on osimertinib, Stephen? Findings in terms of MET or any other targetable alterations that'll get you to use targeted therapy? If you could, would you use patritumab? Would you use lazertinib, amivantamab? And how do you feel about IOs in EGFR mutant disease? I think we used to feel like, oh, they don't work. Then I kind of been hearing some stories more recently about sometimes it does work. So what's your take on the patient progressing on OC, Stephen?
Well, I think my practice has shifted a little bit. In the past, I would do liquid biopsy first, looking for a driver. And if we saw MET, RET, BRAF, then I would look for combinations. And if we didn't see anything, then I would do a tissue biopsy. That's shifted a little bit. Now I really do tissue biopsy up front because we've had a few cases where we've seen something on liquid, like C797S, like MET, but we still did a biopsy and it was still small cell, showing that you can have divergent evolution, that C797S doesn't protect you from small cell, and clearly that's a different management. So I think these coexist, really try to do biopsy, but we saw from the ELIOS trial at ESMO, presented by Zosia Piotrowska, that even in a study where it was designed just to do serial biopsies, just to do paired biopsies, they were only successful 39% of the time. So real world, it's just hard to do a tissue biopsy all the time. And when we can't, if I don't find anything, I think chemotherapy is probably underused. While I do explore combinations, I find they're well tolerated just because OC is so well tolerated. I think chemotherapy is still a very good option. And I'm not sure that combining MET or RET inhibitors is going to be better long term than just giving chemotherapy. Now, the IO question, I really distinguish whether they have CNS metastases or not, because if we have brain mets, I feel like OC is important to continue, and I will continue that even with chemotherapy. I know the results from the COMPEL trial aren't expected for quite some time, but I think there's a role for OC if there are brain mets, if that's what OC is controlling. If there are no brain mets, one strategy is to look at chemo IO. And while it's not really approved in the US, when we ask our colleagues in Japan, these chemo IO combos with VEGF are something they reach for almost all the time. There's a lot of EGFR in Japan. There must be something there. We are seeing some results. So if you're gonna give IO, you don't wanna give IO alone, some sort of combination. And so maybe it makes sense with VEGF. But again, if someone has brain mets, it's really not a strategy for me because I'm continuing TKI.
And again, in terms of exon 20, Ibi said that she tends to favor amivantamab. How do you make that decision?
Well, mostly I try not to disagree with Ibi, so I'll also use amivantamab. But what I've seen is really there's a lot of regional difference. I think efficacy-wise, while the response rates are different, those waterfall plots are pretty similar. And you know, in my own experience, I think mobocertinib does have some toxicity. But if you look at the duration of response, it was like a year and a half. Regionally, I think there's big differences. And I feel like Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, there's a lot more AMI. I feel like Midwest, there's a lot more MOBO. For me, I involve the patient. And if, for example, it's really hard for them to get to my infusion center, if travel is a big issue, I think MOBO maybe has the leg up. But I'll say overall, I tend to use more AMI.
So, Justin, any questions or questions from the audience there? I'm curious how you all manage these patients who are progressing on OC.
Yeah, great points. I mean, I think that those progressing on OC, we really need to reevaluate their mutation status and then kind of use that information as was discussed here. Question for the panel, Ibi and Stephen. We'll see some other different mutations like EGFR, G719X, and wondering about those kind of unusual EGFR mutations that may come up de novo or in the setting of resistance. What do you do for those patients?
Yeah, I think that we're often, I think it's actually a very good point. I think there's some of them that we know more information about. I think G719 is a common one. 861 is another one that we tend to see as well. I think that the data really come down to osimertinib versus kind of afatinib. We have more kind of evidence with both of those two drugs. I think there's some interesting science going on, led by John Heymach and others, trying to really pin down what are the functional consequences. Is there a rationale for prioritizing one of these drugs versus the other ones? I do tend to reach for osimertinib if I find at least good enough phase 2 data to support the drug in that context.
I'll kind of disagree a little bit with Ibi. I reach for afatinib first, and I know it is more toxic, but unless there's CNS mets where I'll really reach for osi, I feel like afatinib, especially for some where we think HER2 signaling might be important, I kind of reach for afatinib, even though I acknowledge that it is a little more toxic.
Okay. Well, question from the audience is about MOBO toxicity. Could the dose be too high? Do you modify the starting dose of that medication?
Yeah, I would have a very low threshold to modify the starting dose. I think what we learned with various kind of exon 20 targeted therapies is that when you really hit on the target, right, you can have a lot of toxicity. And sometimes the dose that ends up being approved may not be the one that probably is the ideal one in a real world setting. So I think taking the opportunity to titrate the dose as appropriate. But I think one thing we have to remember, and I forgot to say that in my slide, is that we see brain mets in this population of patients. And I don't think any of these drugs has extensive CNS penetration. And as we start to reduce the dose of the drug more and more, that really is even compromising even more the penetration of the CNS.
Maybe you can let Ibi continue with her talk. We wanted her to get into some more targeted therapy. Asked her to talk a little bit about MET, HER2, and KRAS. Also, exploring the point she just made, do all these targetable lesions follow sort of the targeted paradigm? Things like using a TKI or targeted therapy for brain mets without radiation therapy. So maybe we can kind of look at these three alterations and see what the current algorithms are for managing these patients and maybe where things are heading in general with targeted therapy. So Ibi, do you want to continue?
Happy to. I think that we're very fortunate, I will say, in non-small cell lung cancer to have all these targets and all these great therapies. And so the first question I'm going to answer is about MET exon 14 skipping. So in which line of treatment do you administer targeted therapy to your patients with MET exon 14 skipping altered non-small cell lung cancer, and how do you select between capmatinib and tepotinib? And so I think one key point here, again, I always talk about we have to do biomarker testing in everyone. The ideal biomarker test, in my opinion, for MET exon 14 skipping alteration is really an RNA-based assay, so we can comprehensively, NGS assay, so we can comprehensively identify these alterations. We have two approved targeted therapies, so tepotinib and capmatinib, and they're interestingly approved in a line-agnostic fashion, so you can give them first or you can give them after chemotherapy plus or minus immunotherapy. I think in my personal practice, I tend to prioritize targeted therapies here. They both have intracranial activity. I think a key point here to make is the efficacy in the first line versus later line setting that we've seen with each of these two drugs. So tepotinib, when they've looked at the efficacy in treatment naive patients versus patients who've had prior treatment, efficacy is comparable. So about a 45% response rate, median PFS somewhere between 9 and 11 months. That is different from capmatinib. And so this is a smaller data set, but they've actually expanded this data set and seen a similar trend where the response rate is a little bit in the closer to 60 to 70% in the first line setting versus that same 40% that we see with tepotinib in the later line setting. Median PFS also improves when you give it first versus later. And I think one key point that's a little bit distinct from what we talked about with amivantamab and mobocertinib is I think that they're quite comparable in terms of dose reductions and dose discontinuation rate. And so in my practice, I think, again, it's an institutional bias. We had a lot of experience with capmatinib. I tend to prioritize capmatinib, and I think that argument is strengthened by the efficacy in the first line setting. Key thing with these drugs is that they have edema. Edema can be something that's challenging to manage. And so I don't necessarily think that the quality of life is extensively kind of superior to what you might get with chemotherapy in this setting. It's objective response rate and intracranial activity that's swaying me. And so the next question is about HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. And in similar question, so in which line of treatment do you administer targeted therapy for your patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer and HER2 mutations? And because HER2 mutations are not the only story in non-small cell lung cancer, what about those with HER2 overexpression or amplification? And so this is another area where we recently have a selective therapy, right? And this is trastuzumab deruxtecan or TDXD. This is approved for HER2 mutations. We'd seen another antibody drug conjugate, T-DM1, with some phase 2 data in HER2 mutated and HER2 amplified non-small cell lung cancer. It's not approved for that indication, but it has made its way into NCCN guidelines. We do not have the approval for amplification or overexpression with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And so for me, I tend to use T-DXd or trastuzumab deruxtecan in the later line setting, although if my colleagues say they're using it in the first line setting, I don't think that's unreasonable. The reason that I paused a little is that when we first saw data with this drug at the 6.4 mg per kg dose, there was a 26% interstitial lung disease rate. And so that prompted the FDA to say, hey, go test it at a lower dose, so 5.4 mg per kg versus 6.4 mg per kg. This is a DESTINY-Lung02 study presented here. And what we saw encouragingly was that you didn't compromise the efficacy, but you improved the safety with this. ILD rate is single digit, so 6% here. The rate of dose discontinuation, dose reduction were also improved at this lower dose. And so for me, I'm keeping an eye on DESTINY-Lung04, which is randomizing patients to chemo plus immunotherapy versus this trastuzumab deruxtecan in the first line setting. I still, in my practice, I do tend to do chemo first before moving to T-DXd, but I do not think it's wrong to do the reverse. As for our next question, again, similar question, but this time KRAS G12C mutation. So what line of treatment do you administer targeted therapy for metastatic non-small cell lung cancer with a KRAS G12C mutation? And how, again, do you select between two available drugs, sotorasib and adagrasib? So here, I think the story is a little bit different, right? And so we used to say forever that we could not target KRAS. Here we are now with two drugs in this space. For all intents and purposes, efficacy-wise, I think they're comparable, right? We have response rates in the 40%, median PFS at around 6 months, median OS around 12 months. Sotorasib got there first. I think we have to acknowledge we don't have head-to-head data, but one sticking point that my eyes are naturally drawn to when I look at the data sets is the higher rate of dose reduction with adagrasib and the higher rate of certain gastrointestinal and LFT elevations with this particular drug. Doesn't lead to a higher rate of dose discontinuation, but since I already have sotorasib, there's only one population of patient that I do tend to think about adagrasib as a preferential therapy for, and that's patients with baseline brain metastases, just because we have more robust prospective data for that cohort. That is not to say that sotorasib does not work in brain metastases, but it is the data that we have at hand. As far as what line of therapy I use it in, I was recently humbled by CodeBreaK 200, which randomized patients to sotorasib versus docetaxel in the later line setting, and while we saw a modest improvement in the median PFS, increase in overall response rate, and there wasn't an improvement in overall survival, I still think that those numbers were quite modest. I think we can get similar numbers with chemotherapy in the first line setting. This is the later line setting, and I'm looking at a 40% response rate, so I think we need combinations, we need more data personally before I move these to the first line setting over chemotherapy or immunotherapy, where for some subsets of KRAS mutant lung cancer, we can get quite durable responses.
So many questions coming in. We'll turn to Justin in a second, but just to pick up on a few of these. So, Stephen, we were talking about HER2 mutant lung cancer. What about HER2 overexpressed or amplified disease? Obviously, in breast cancer and GI cancers, that's more of a target for T-DXd. What do we know about it in lung cancer? And also, Ibi was talking about, you know, that higher doses are just more toxic. What about lower doses? We had a couple of 90-year-olds presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer meeting, and the doc started out with a low dose and escalated up. Do you ever do that? And also, again, this issue of overexpression of HER2, Stephen.
These are great questions. I do think HER2 expression is coming as a biomarker for lung cancer. There was efficacy. The response rate was a lot lower than in HER2 mutant, but it was still probably about the same as you would see with docetaxel-based therapies. And so I do think there's promise there. It needs to be studied in sort of larger groups. And it's sort of a challenge because we're not doing HER2 IHC for lung cancer, really not doing much IHC at all apart from PD-L1. But I do think that is coming, but it needs larger studies. With regard to dose, generally I find that for most of us, if we started a lower dose with the plan to escalate, we usually don't escalate. Usually people have some tox and you're kind of stuck with that dose. And I do think there's some relationship. This lower dose of 5.4 was more effective and better tolerated, and the rate of pneumonitis was very low in the single digits. So I do feel comfortable with it, and I have given it to quite elderly patients and pretty well tolerated. You know, think about growth factor support, think about close monitoring, but I would probably stick with that 5.4 because, you know, I think the greater threat is really just not adequately treating the cancer.
So, Ibi, another question that came in the chat room, and I think it maybe goes beyond this specific question. This is from Dan, who wants to know, how do you treat exon 20 up front, and specifically, do you give immunotherapy with chemotherapy? And I would extend that all the way down to all, you know, KRAS, BRAF, all the mutations. It's kind of hard for, I mean, we hear a lot about EGFR and ALK, Ibi. But once you get to the other ones, it's kind of hard to separate out. Do you give an IO with the chemo or not? What about exon 20? And what about all the other, you know, newer mutations?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So let me start with exon 20. And so that's why I said chemo plus or minus immunotherapy. I think that if you ask 50 of my colleagues, you may get kind of different answers from everyone. Again, if I'm thinking that I'm going to be giving kind of TDXD or trastuzumab deruxtecan in the second line setting, and we really haven't sorted out the biology of what's driving that pneumonitis rate, it makes me hesitate to give immunotherapy as part of the chemo in the first line setting. And I also think that if I'm lumping and I'm splitting, I tend to lump exon 20 with our never smoking driven cancers, EGFR, ALK, et cetera, where we have pretty nice data that suggests some prospective, some retrospective, suggesting that patients aren't really benefiting from immunotherapy, at least as a monotherapy. I think where that kind of hypothesis diverges a little bit is when we start talking about subsets that we can actually see in patients who have smoking history, patients with kind of other features that are more predictive of benefit from immunotherapy. The examples being kind of KRAS, MET exon 14 skipping, sometimes BRAF, depending on the demographic subset.
So I'll go to Justin in a second, but just a couple more questions from the chat room, Stephen. So Dr. Kumar has I don't even know the trade names. I have to like translate in my head. But anyhow, I think he has somebody on Dabtrem for BRAF disease who's doing great after 2 years. So really great response. Anything you can do targeted after the patient progresses, Stephen? And then I've got another interesting case here. From Dr. Malady, who has a 55-year-old non-smoking patient, a woman with metastatic adeno, EGFR L858R, planning to start OC, and the NGS shows a T790 mutation with high allele burden, suggesting germline T790. I remember hearing about this in the old T790 days, and then it sort of went away once osimertinib came in. So any thoughts about second line therapy and somebody who had a great response to Dabtrem for BRAF? And what about this case of maybe T790 germline, Stephen?
So for BRAF V600E after dabrafenib, trametinib, and I've had also similar patients where really get really a lot of mileage out of targeted therapy. At progression, for me, it's chemo IO. And as Ibi mentioned, you know, we can see immunotherapy responses, I think especially if they have a smoking history. But I will have one patient that comes to mind who was on dabrafenib, trametinib for about a year and a half. We switched to chemotherapy, had a pretty good response. After chemotherapy, she wanted to go back to dabrafenib, trametinib, and I told her this really shouldn't work a second course, but she had minimal tumor symptoms. We gave it a try, and she's been on that second course of Dabtrem for another year. So maybe we can revisit some of these. Maybe some of the population that grows back during chemo or is resistant might retain sensitivity to targeted agents. In terms of next-gen targeted drugs, we've seen a lot come and go. It's been a little disappointing in that space, unfortunately. I don't know if Ibi has seen anything different, but really we want more out of those spaces. You know, I'm getting a little bit older. The second question was
T790. Yeah, this is like a memory test. If you can remember all the questions here, yeah. T790 germline.
Yeah, you're right. We heard a lot about that in early days, and we know that that does increase the risk for EGFR mutant lung cancer. It was a little more relevant when we were using first gen TKIs. Here, we do still see it, and I think it's important in terms of counseling patients and their families with regard to risk for developing EGFR mutant lung cancer. I would think osimertinib will still be effective. The cases that I've seen, there haven't been a whole lot. They've responded to OC, but I think you got to watch closely because the responses I've seen have been much more short-lived. It's not really clear why, because T790M shouldn't impact the efficacy of OC, but my own experience, those responses have been a lot shorter, and I wouldn't hesitate to go to chemotherapy the first sign of growth.
So again, but before we go back to Justin Bossom in the chat room, IBI wants to know exon 18 EGFR.
Like L858R or L861? There's a couple of them. Yeah, I think that this is one of the, if it's not a exon 21, sorry, exon 18. So these are a little bit rarer, but I do think that we have some data with either afatinib or kind of osimertinib with some of these. In these cases, I tend to look up various databases online, talk with my molecular pathology colleagues to see where the data stand.
So Justin, any questions about targeted therapy before we start moving into immunotherapy?
Two practical questions on the KRAS inhibitor, sotorasib. Do you ever combine that with cetuximab? And the second question is about taking PPIs with those medications. Most patients are on them, and how does that affect absorption?
Yeah, so the first one with cetuximab, I think that strategy has kind of borne out in colorectal cancer. Again, so when we think about KRAS mutant non-small cell lung cancer, and when we think about targeted therapies in general, we get excited about response rates of 60 to 70%, right? Then here we're talking about response rates of about 40%. And the speculation and the hypothesis is that there is something else that is driving kind of downstream MAPK activation, and sometimes that's upregulation of existing growth factors, EGFR being one, particularly very relevant in colorectal cancer, probably relevant to some degree in non-small cell lung cancer as well. I think the data are probably most robust for colorectal cancer, but there are ongoing studies doing a variety of combinations for KRAS mutant non-small cell lung cancer. As far as the PPI question, I don't know that I have a specific question. I usually work with our pharmacists around this. I think one thing that we did run into, though, was that some of the QTC prolonging drugs and antiemetics with adagrasib in particular, and it's something that we have to work closely with our pharmacists to find the right cocktail of antiemetics that are not compromising kind of the drug levels.
So we're getting a lot of questions about immunotherapy, even though we haven't talked about it. But just one more case that we have here in the chat room. What a terrible situation, Stephen. Uzoma has a 59-year-old patient, stage 4, the lung, PD-L1 60%, gets chemo plus IO, has a CR, is out 2 years, still in CR, now has brain mets. Sounds like HER2-positive breast cancer, but anyhow, any thoughts, Stephen? Have you seen this?
I have. I've actually seen several cases of this. And, you know, we used to think years ago, Neil, we would say once you made it to 2 years, you were set. We wouldn't expect those to come back. We know now that that's simply not the case, that we can see late recurrence, and we're still trying to understand why that happens. But I've had several cases with CNS-only relapse. And an important point is I think CNS monitoring is really important in terms of long-term surveillance. And I still do an MRI once a year for everyone, because every once in a while you pick something up asymptomatically. If it were one or two, SRS, and then observe and hope there's not more. But I've had a couple where it's been multiple and it would have been whole brain. If someone doesn't have a lot of edema, I think I have a little bit of time. Those are cases where I have done Nevo-Ipi, and I know I'm extrapolating from melanoma, but I've had kind of good success with it. I also had one patient who just happened to be BRCA positive with a lot of brain mets, and actually gave her a PARP. And we had good outcomes with that too. I did PARP Pembro off-label, and she had really good outcomes. But general, if I can't do radiation, if it's going to be too extensive, I will try Nevo-Ipi, and I have had some success. We'll see how long that lasts.
So, Ibi, any thoughts about this case? So, as I started to read it, I was like, oh, here's the typical, how do you stop an IO if the patient's doing well? And then, oh my gosh. Anyhow, I also am curious, do you stop IOs at 2 years or any particular time and patients are doing well?
I suppose the answer should be yes, right? If we are faithful to the data. But I think that I borrow from my melanoma colleagues, or I'm starting to borrow from their thought process. At least internally at our institution, people are really adopting PET and other strategies to try to guide them, and kind of the not necessarily duration, but the degree of response, right? So if someone had a tremendous response, or if they're having a tough time with the therapy, I think I'm more pushed to stop after 2 years. I think if someone has a lot of bulky disease, residual disease, et cetera, I think I might be more inclined to try to continue, but I am starting to have the conversation at the beginning now, saying, hey, the way this study was done, you're supposed to stop at 2 years. And the reason is we don't know what happens to the immune system if you continue beyond 2 years, to be honest. There's all sorts of theories about exhaustion, et cetera.
So, Stephen, as soon as we sat down, as soon as the chat room started, I started to see questions about neoadjuvant IO. So still a subject of great debate, and adjuvant IO as well, and that's what you're going to cover right now. So let's talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, when we think about localized lung cancer, really our preference is to get patients to surgery. And our goal there for surgery really is chemotherapy. If we think, or really is surgery to get the cure, think of this question: which patient should receive adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor? How do we choose between OC and immunotherapy in patients that might qualify for both? You know, for surgery, that's our best chance to cure someone with a stage 2 or 3 lung cancer. It's surgical resection. But we know that for a resected stage 3A lung cancer, while surgery and chemotherapy will hopefully get us to cure, that might be our goal. It's not our expectation. Most patients are not cured with chemoradiation. The vast majority will recur and eventually die of their disease. The outcomes are very poor. Chemotherapy, cisplatin-based chemotherapy, that's our standard of care. The benefit realistically is modest, a pretty minimal benefit in terms of long-term survival. In some of those studies, like the IALT study, at 10 years, there was no difference in survival. And so that may even decrease a bit over time. We know immunotherapy can improve disease-free survival. For about a year and a half, we've had the approval of atezolizumab based on EMPOWER-010. This was a randomized phase 3 study looking at the PD-L1 inhibitor atezolizumab for resected lung cancer. And what we saw is that in PD-L1 positive, resected stage 2-3, there was a DFS benefit. The interim survival analysis also showed the suggestion of a survival benefit for the PD-L1 high group as well, though it's not quite mature. The greatest benefit was in PD-L1 high, with a hazard ratio of 0.43, pretty convincing. PD-L1 low is around 0.85, 0.87. PD-L1 negative, no signal really of benefit. So atezolizumab approved, and I think we have general consensus that in PD-L1 high, there's clear benefit. PD-L1 low was a little bit of a discussion. This really fit in with our preconceived notions of how immunotherapy should work. Should work best in PD-L1 high, should work a little in PD-L1 low, probably not going to work in PD-L1 negative. So this really fit with what we know about immunotherapy. It got turned on its ear a few weeks ago with the approval of pembrolizumab based on the PEARL study, KEYNOTE-091. This was a randomized phase 3 trial, little different design, placebo-controlled. Primary endpoint here, disease-free survival in all comers. And this was positive in all comers with a hazard ratio of 0.76 for DFS. And that's the approval. The approval is all comers with no PD-L1 selection. And when we looked at the PD-L1 subsets, the PD-L1 high had actually the lowest DFS hazard ratio. PD-L1 low was the best, and the PD-L1 negative had a clear signal. So it didn't really fit with what we expected for PD-L1. Didn't make sense. That's why I think a lot of us have kind of ignored these data, because we don't quite know what to make of it. My thinking on this has really shifted a little bit, because when we look at this study, this was a randomized phase 3 trial. This was the primary endpoint. And while we come in with these preconceived notions of what the PD-L1 data should look like based on these pembrolizumab studies, the data are the data. And I think that you have to hold the evidence to a pretty high bar. This is power to answer this question, and so I do think that it's a reasonable thing to think of in someone that's PD-L1 negative. So who should receive adjuvant immunotherapy after surgery and chemo? Well, atezo's approved, pembro's approved. Generally, we individualize this. We're thinking of risk. We're thinking of comorbidities and the risk of recurrence. For PD-L1 high, I think the data are strongest for atezo, hazard ratio of 0.43. PD-L1 low, PD-L1 negative, I think the data are strong enough for pembro that I do offer it. And in fact, I do recommend it. And I know that the data are a little conflicting, but I think that it's a phase 3 trial. This is the endpoint. So I offer adjuvant immunotherapy pretty much every resected stage 2-3 lung cancer. The exception really would be if there's an EGFR mutation. And there are many cases where we'll see an EGFR mutation and PD-L1 positivity and even high PD-L1 expression. And how do you choose between those two? And we know clearly you choose the EGFR. That high PD-L1 in the setting of an EGFR mutation means something different. We know that from the stage 4 setting. While the PEARLS data is a little conflicting in terms of subset data, I think clearly osimertinib is the right choice there. In addition, because of something Ibi mentioned in her slides, if you were to start with immunotherapy and they were to relapse, giving osimertinib in that setting would be much more difficult, much more toxic. So I think TKI is the way to go when the EGFR is there. That really trumps the PD-L1 expression. Now, what about for stage 3 unresectable? For stage 3 unresectable, our standard treatment is chemoradiation and then durvalumab consolidation. In what settings would we not give durva there? We know Pacific is our clear, undeniable, irrefutable champion here. Clear benefit in PFS, survival curves that split immediately, that widen, and that's maintained, a clear 5-year survival benefit. Durva is really the major advance we've had in the unresectable stage 3. That's our standard of care. But in EGFR, we know that subset didn't get as much benefit. There was not a significant improvement in outcomes. As we talked about, giving TKI after relapse on Durva would be much more challenging. We will have a study asking this question, the LAURA trial, but overall, because I think Durva is not going to provide much benefit, because it would be harder to give targeted therapy afterwards, and because of the CNS benefit seen in the DORA, I do not give Durva for EGFR. And in fact, even though it's off-label, I do recommend osimertinib in that setting. I also extrapolate to ALK, and I will recommend an ALK inhibitor after chemo radiation, because again, I don't think that you're getting that IO benefit. I think the risk of relapse is just way too high.
So, wow, a lot to talk about there. Ibi, can you talk a little bit about how you're approaching not only the issue of adjuvant, but also neoadjuvant therapy? And what situations are you doing neoadjuvant IO, chemo, and how are you thinking through with this new approval how you're going to approach the adjuvant situation based on PD-1 level?
Yeah, I think if I had my way, right, if I were surgeon, medical oncologist, pathologist all at once, I would probably prioritize giving everything up front. And the reason is that we get a lot of information that way, right? Biologically, you have a larger burden of tumor, easier for the immune system to recognize it and patrol once you remove the tumor. And two, I get an early readout about how effective it is, and there's an opportunity to give additional therapy afterwards. So if it were up to me and perfect scenario, that's what I would do. But that takes a lot of coordination, right? You have to do the molecular testing, make sure they don't have EGFR and ALK. You have to align the appropriate kind of multidisciplinary team to get the treatment kind of implemented without delaying care. I know I've been reassured by the data suggesting that we don't get toxicities that preclude surgery for patients in this setting.
So before I go back to Justin Uzoma, who gave that fascinating case of the patient with the brain mass after 2 years, has another interesting case. Stephen, I'm curious how you think this one through. 46-year-old woman, new diagnosis of non-small cell adeno, 1.6 centimeter primary, N3 with contralateral hilar node and station 7 node, stage 3B, T1, N3, M0. Would you consider neoadjuvant chemo IO, Stephen, or generally, how would you think through this case?
That's a good question. I think it's pushing the limits a little bit with surgery with N3 involvement. I think it's a question that should be asked. And the fact that Georgetown were developing a trial looking at contralateral adenopathy. Contralateral hilar, though, while it may not technically be much different than a contralateral mediastinal in terms of the surgeon, I think we're a little pushing the boundaries a bit. I think right now for an N3, my recommendation is chemo radiation.
So, Justin, any questions there from the group?
Yeah, it's a question about the neoadjuvant with nivolumab, and just kind of curious what chemotherapy regimens you choose and how many cycles do you give prior to surgery?
So I generally stick with the data here, and I'm using CheckMate 816 and Nadeem. They were built on a carboplatin backbone. Carboplatin's a lot easier than the cisplatin, which is what we usually give neoadjuvant, but I think that carboplatin nevo regimen is still what I'm sticking with. I do three cycles, although, you know, we saw at ASCO 3 was better than 2. A lot of people ask, is 4 better than 3? And the upcoming trials at GN and Power-030, those all feature 4 cycles. So I think that right now I'm doing 3 cycles, sticking to the label, but I do think 4 is probably inevitable.
So, Ibi, what would you do in this situation? A patient with locally advanced disease gets chemotherapy radiation, then gets put on durvalumab, and relapses on durvalumab, and around the same time is found to have an EGFR activating mutation. And we've been warned about the idea of using TKIs right after an IO. Of course, I guess it would matter how symptomatic the patient might be. But generally speaking, you know, of course, you maybe you want to wait. I guess the question is, how long would you wait? How do you think through that situation, Ibi?
Yeah, I sigh. I think that's a tough one, right? Because you know what the best therapy for the patient is. It's an EGFR TKI, but you also know that when people, there's retrospective data, but there's also direct data where they combine the two, there's hepatitis, there's pneumonitis, there's death associated with it. And so it's not a benign undertaking. And I don't think we have kind of scientific data to say how long. So if I say I want to give chemo to bridge for a few months to wash the IO out, if they've had a one year of durvalumab, that's going to be in their system for a while. So I think I would have a very kind of significant conversation with the patient. In some people, I might give a little chemo first, but I have to say I would be strongly inclined to at least try the EGFR TKI and just be very vigilant in my monitoring for toxicity.
And Stephen, it also reminds me of the another scenario I hear a lot of cases of patients who present are very sick, they're in the ICU, they need immediate treatment, but you don't have your markers back, you don't have your NGS back. And the question is, do you use an IO or do you wait for the NGS? I've actually heard people say they approach that situation differently, whether or not the patient's a smoker. But I'm just kind of curious, Stephen, in general, how do you think that went through?
So in general, the concern here is if we give IO and then we want to give targeted therapy, we know that it's much more toxic. And some of those toxicities can be fatal. So the stakes are pretty high. In that setting, we're going to give chemotherapy. We're going to do chemo alone up front, because if there's no driver, I can add immunotherapy. And starting immunotherapy with cycle 2 instead of cycle 1 probably doesn't make much difference long term. And if there is a target, then I can stop the chemotherapy, walk back from that pretty easily, and then move on to targeted therapy. Of course, the other thing is if they're really sick and in the hospital, getting immunotherapy can be a little expensive based on the DRG, and our P&T committee, of which I'm chair, is not going to allow us to do that.
So again, before Stephen gives the final talk, the final chalk talk of the day, Justin, any other questions from the audience?
A couple questions. One is using the targeted agents in the adjuvant setting, osimertinib and ALK targeted agents, others. If you decide to do that, how long would you continue those? And do you look at all the different mutations in the adjuvant setting or just the EGFR?
So I generally favor the adjuvant TKIs. Osimertinib is approved here. I've already adopted ALK inhibitors here. I think that's going to be positive. If anything, it's going to be more positive. The other targeted agents, BRAF, MET, I think the therapeutic window is just smaller because they're more toxic. It's hard to continue those long term. So I'm not using those. But for EGFR, for ALK, definitely using TKI. But my own personal thought here, Justin, and I don't know, the data doesn't back it up yet, I don't know that these are curing more people. When we saw in the ADAURA trials, after year 3, when you stop treatment, at year 4, there's kind of a big drop. And I think some people are cured, but those people are probably cured after the chemo. And I don't know how much the TKI is going to add. I suspect that over time, we're going to see what we saw in the Chinese trials, that those curves are going to banana and meet at some point. So I don't think it's curing more people. With that in mind, I do think that as long as you're taking it, it's going to keep that cancer away. So if resources are not a question, I would continue it for 3 years, have a discussion at 3 years. And for some of my patients who started earlier, 3 years has kind of come and gone, and we've decided to continue that kind of indefinitely if it's being well tolerated. However, I leave the caveat that, you know, I have a few patients where the copay is really high, $1,000, $2,000 a month, and it's hard to sort of maintain that indefinitely because I don't think there really will be a survival benefit. I sort of allow that window, saying if we can't afford this, if we can't continue this, we can stop and we watch closely and then restart a progression if it were to occur. But in those patients that are not on TKI, it's critical that we do MRI to watch, because we saw in ADAURA in that placebo arm, 10% of recurrence was in the brain.
This is a question from the audience. It's about a patient who progressed on neoadjuvant chemo IO and then was treated with concurrent chemo radiation. And the question is, did that patient get consolidation immunotherapy?
Yeah, I think it's a tough one. And so the hope every time we give neoadjuvant therapy is that we can get the patient to surgery, right? And so if they progress that rapidly, despite, I guess, it's 3 cycles of immunotherapy, I'm assuming. I think here we're extrapolating. It's all off-label. I might consider it, but I think that there's a strong rationale for saying they didn't have quite a response to those initial 3 cycles. But as Stephen mentioned, right, how do we know that 3 cycles is enough, right? Some tumors need more than 3 cycles. They're exploring 2, they're exploring 4, et cetera. So I think it depends on tolerance. Any toxicity that they had from chemo radiation, I might consider continuing it. And I think this is to speak to Stephen's prior question and to this scenario as well, I think that there's incredible opportunity in non-small cell lung cancer to learn from colorectal cancer and learn from some of our early studies to do these like minimal residual disease monitoring, get more sensitive assays to try to figure out who is truly cured and who is not, to really guide our decisions with respect to how long we should be continuing therapy and who we're overtreating.
So maybe I just correlate on that then. So basically somebody does actually do well in neoadjuvant chemo immunotherapy and has surgery, Do you offer them the neoadjuvant immunotherapy afterwards?
So I think here we use a couple of data points. The one that's probably most clinic ready is the path CR, right? I think someone has a path CR, I'm not giving additional therapy. I think if someone has a lot of residual tumor, there are ongoing studies that will answer some of that question. So similar design to CheckMate 816, but they have kind of the outback immunotherapy afterwards. I think this is something that is very much debated at my institution about, like, if someone had a ton of residual disease, do you give additional chemo? Because as it stands, 816 does not allow for additional immunotherapy. And the question is, why would you do the same thing if it didn't work, right? And so do you switch to a different chemo in that setting? These are all great questions, and I think we have to answer them in a prospective fashion for us to really inform practice.
So maybe we can move on and hear the final talk of the day in terms of metastatic disease and the use of immune therapy, Stephen.
Sure. Thanks, Neil. These are important topics, and we've touched on some of these already. The first question here, in general, when should checkpoint inhibitors be introduced for patients with driver alterations? And we know from a wealth of data that for these non-smoking driver mutations, immunotherapy has been pretty disappointing. Response rates in the 5% or less range. We also know in the frontline setting with PD-L1 positive, even PD-L1 high EGFR mutant lung cancer, the response rate to Pembro was zero. And this study did include some patients with EGFR exon 20. In addition, as we talked about multiple times, when we give a TKI after IO, in this setting, in driver-positive lung cancer, it's more toxic, and some of those toxicities are fatal. We don't know why. In this study, one patient who received Pembro didn't respond, then moved on to erlotinib, died from a fatal pneumonitis about 5 weeks later. So the stakes are pretty high. Generally, I would not give immunotherapy if TKI was still on the board. I would think about immunotherapy only after we've exhausted TKI therapy because really I think it's too toxic. We know that for EGFR, but we also see toxicities with ALK, mostly hepatitis, with RET, with this hypersensitivity reaction and dropping blood pressure and arthralgias, and it's probably true for all of them to some extent. Now, exceptions are ones that we see in smokers. So BRAF V600E, MedX14, we see those drivers in smokers. They can respond well to IO. Because I do think there's tox based on sequence, I'll still start with TKI, but if they're not responding, I generally will give IO in those settings with the chemotherapy. There is a suggestion that giving VEGF inhibitors can enhance the efficacy of immunotherapy. Some preclinical work that's been done mostly from John Heymach, and as I said, this is a regimen that's really used frequently in Asia. And I think that if you're not going to give TKI, if there's no CNS involvement, I think this is a very reasonable way to give immunotherapy. My current practice is to use TKI first to save IO until we're clearly done with TKI. And really, if we're going to continue TKI for CNS example, I'm not going to give immunotherapy there. Exceptions are KRAS G12C for a couple of reasons. As Ibi, I mentioned, the response rate to the currently approved KRAS G12C inhibitors is a little on the lower side, around 40%. They're still very good drugs, but not quite high enough to use in the frontline setting. In addition, there are patients that we will treat with a KRAS G12C inhibitor who will be cured with immunotherapy. And if I start with targeted therapy, there's a chance we'll never get to immunotherapy, and I don't want to deprive them of that opportunity. Some of my best long-term outcomes, people that are 10 years out, were KRAS G12C that got immunotherapy up front. So immunotherapy is still part of my frontline treatment because I'm not willing to sacrifice the opportunity to really cure those patients. Now, this is sort of, I think, the hardest question. How do we approach the decision to use monotherapy versus combined versus dual checkpoint in newly diagnosed lung cancer without an actionable alteration? And in the U.S., it's really an embarrassment of riches. We have a wealth of options that are all FDA approved and that all have very good long-term outcomes. They have comparable PFS rates and survivals years later. Monotherapy with atezo, pembro, cemiplimab. We have dual checkpoint alone, nivo-ipi, approved for PD-L1 positive, and multiple chemo IO options. Most recently, the addition of cemiplimab to chemo based on the PowerLung 3, nivo-ipi chemo with only two cycles of chemotherapy for CheckMate 9LA, and Poseidon with chemotherapy, four cycles, durvalumab, and then five doses of tremelimumab, the Poseidon regimen. All of these, I think, are clearly better than chemotherapy. So one thing we agree on, we should not be giving chemo alone unless there's a clear contraindication to immunotherapy. But how do we choose among these? Well, my practice really for PD-L1 high is still to use monotherapy. And pembrolizumab is what we use. Cemiplimab, atezo, I think those data are very comparable. If there was any type of formulary restriction, I wouldn't hesitate to make a switch. Right now I use pembro just because that was first and didn't really see a reason to change my own EMR and my own pathways. If there's a lot of tumor burden, a lot of symptoms, a rapid pace, even for PD-L1 high, then I want to add in chemotherapy. But I will say I have a lower threshold in those patients to stop the chemotherapy early, and I probably won't continue the pemetrexed maintenance indefinitely just because I think it's probably not necessary. Our long-term outcomes in the PD-L1 high group, thinking about two-year PFS rates, are pretty similar between monotherapy and chemotherapy. The main difference is that upfront PFS benefit with giving chemotherapy. So if I'm worried they're not going to make it a couple months because their tumor burden's too high, they're too symptomatic, in those cases I'll give chemotherapy, but it tends to drop off a little earlier in the PD-L1 high group. PD-L1 low and negative, I use chemo IO. That's sort of what was approved first, and while dual checkpoint blockade I think looks very good, and when we look at duration of response, it's quite exciting. I think that they're pretty comparable in terms of short-term PFS rates, and I just didn't see a reason to change practice. If I truly had someone that couldn't get chemotherapy, a non-squamous lung cancer where the creatinine clearance wouldn't allow us to give pemetrexed, I think nivo-ipi is a good option. Where I'd like to give nivo-ipi the most is probably in the PD-L1 negative squamous population where it's not really FDA approved. So in that setting, I'm still using chemo-IO. I think the Poseidon data in the context of an STK11 and KRAS co-mutation is very interesting, even compelling, but it's pretty small numbers. And so right now, I'm still chemo-IO, but we're watching sort of long-term outcomes and we're willing to adapt. If I did have someone that got IO before, like neoadjuvant, adjuvant, or consolidation durvalumab recurred later, there I do want to escalate a little bit. And so in those settings, I'm probably going to give dual checkpoint blockade, even with chemotherapy, because I think that's a bad tumor. We're really going to try to get better outcomes. I'm going to throw everything I have at it. And so what role, if any, do we believe datopotamab deruxtecan? By the way, we can just sort of say out loud, these ADCs have ridiculous names, and they're pronounced entirely differently by everybody. We call this one data potato at our institution. What role will it eventually play in metastatic lung cancer, and would we use this today? And one important point about these TROP2 antibody-drug conjugates, you know, when we think of ADCs, they're nice because they seem to have these built-in biomarkers. You've got an antibody, you should be able to measure expression of the antigen, and that's your biomarker. And in lung cancer, it's almost never the case, really. Only CEACAM is following that strategy. We don't see it with TROP2, we don't see it with HER3, we don't see it with HER2. It's really kind of frustrating. But for TROP2, the selection right now, there's no IHC selection. They seem to work equally well across the board, but the response rates are around that 25-30% range. And so even though it is a targeted drug, the efficacy and the toxicity align a lot more closely to chemotherapy. And we don't see response rates of 50%, 80%, 90%. It really is something I think is clearly better than docetaxel, but I don't think it's better than platinum doublet chemotherapy. So if I had it available today, I'd be using it after platinum doublet chemotherapy, before docetaxel, and I think it can work equally well in driver-positive cancers and non-drivers. I don't think it'll work better in driver-positive cancers, but I think it's a better option than docetaxel. We'll have some data looking at these drugs in the frontline setting, but they're too toxic to combine with everything, and so you're swapping out some agent probably. But combining it with pembro chemo, that'll be what we look at in the future, and those studies are probably still a few years away. So TROP-ADCs, still clearly active. Again, if available today, I'm using this after platinum doublet chemotherapy, but before docetaxel.
So I like the dato potato thing, and even though you're not that excited about it, look, if it pushes docetaxel out of second line or docetaxel or amivantamab, at least I'll give it that credit for maybe people feeling better. We'll go to Justin in a second for any final questions, but I just want to ask one other question, Ibi. And it was sparked by the Stephen was talking about the adjuvant pembro versus adjuvant atezo. And I want to ask you a real broad question that goes beyond lung cancer in general. I was thinking about this last night when we were doing the bladder program, and they were talking about infusion reactions and arthralgias with avelumab, which I guess you guys don't actually even use. But in any event, my question is, right now at this point, in general, is there any way to separate out IOs in terms of efficacy, tolerability, PD-1 versus PD-L1? You know, generally speaking, the message we've been getting in general oncology over the years is you really can't separate them out. Of course, everybody's really interested in terms of efficacy. Is it still that situation, or do you think you can? I hear other people start to say they think they can see differences in terms of toxicity and efficacy. Ibi, any thoughts?
I mean, to be honest, I have not seen a major difference between them. I think at one point, the biggest kind of difference between them was the dosing interval, right? Something was Q4, something was Q6, something was Q2 versus Q3. I think that there was some speculation earlier on that maybe a PD-L1 inhibitor versus a PD-1 inhibitor, maybe there was some more pneumonitis. I've not seen that pan out, honestly. I do think that there might be slight differences in some of the molecules, right? Some are kind of leveraging ADCC, other types of mechanisms. I just don't know that we have substantial enough data to prompt me to say that I've seen a difference in toxicity profile. I don't know, Stephen, have you?
So I think that the molecules clearly are different, right? They have different epitopes, they have different half-lives, they're more likely to elicit antibodies. But these differences, I think, are too subtle. There was a head-to-head we saw phase two at ESMO IO of dostarlimab versus, I think it was Pembro, and there seem to be some differences. I just don't think we're at the point right now where we can leverage those differences in a meaningful way. So I think the only meaningful differences in the clinic today are in indication and cost.
I was just thinking, Justin, you presented a couple of the cases we showed this week at the GU meeting. Actually, I was thinking about your cases. Anyhow, any final questions from the room, Justin?
I have a question just about pulmonary toxicity with these agents. If you could look, kind of think about the antibody-drug conjugates and the pulmonary toxicity there versus the IO toxicity, can you kind of compare and contrast and how you handle that when you find things on the scan?
So I can speak from our experience. The pneumonitis we've seen with antibody-drug conjugates has not been as sort of long-lasting as what we see with immunotherapy. With immunotherapy, we learned early on that when you stop those steroids after 3 weeks or so, that pneumonitis often will just sort of come right back, and we really need these long tapers of steroids to keep people safe. I haven't really seen that with the antibody-drug conjugates, where you see the pneumonitis, relatively brief courses of steroids generally tend to get it out, and I haven't really seen recurrence of those.
No, I would agree. And I think the mechanisms are different too, right? One, you're inflaming the immune system to attack the lung tissue, and the other, at least in the context of kind of deruxtecan-based ADCs, it was speculated that it had something to do with the reticuloendothelial system and kind of the macrophages, their kind of interacting with the drug components. And so there may be, as we've seen with DESTINY-Lung02, some dose dependency to that as well. I think the interesting thing is that we don't see that exact same rate of pneumonitis when you have deruxtecan attached to kind of patritumab or other drugs, right? And so I think there's something about both the target and the payload, and there's certainly something distinct, I think, from an IO-induced pneumonitis versus an ADC-induced pneumonitis, but treated with steroids nonetheless and stopping drug.
Very good. Well, thank you. And there's a lot about all this other studies out there looking at new agents. I saw a recent study from Sarah Cannon using anti-TIGIT antibody combined with a PD-1 showing a 50% improvement in progression-free survival. This is another antibody that hits a immunosuppressive target on the T cell. What are you guys excited about? Like something we haven't talked about today, it might be coming out soon in the next year or so that might revolutionize treatment for lung cancer.
Well, we know that the TIGIT study, the phase three in lung cancer, didn't hit its PFS endpoint, but we're waiting to see the OS endpoint, did not really show any improvement in small cell. I think the ADCs are going to play more of a role in the frontline setting, and I think those combinations are worth exploring. But I'm actually, especially for driver-positive cancers, I really think cellular therapy is going to play a much bigger role in the years to come. We heard some great talks earlier today about some of the bispecifics, trispecifics in different diseases. I think those are going to play a role in lung cancer, and we'll see those, especially in small cell, coming in the next few years.
Yeah, and from my standpoint, a great answer is always kind of lung screening. I hope that we detect cancers earlier, but I know that we often do not. And so I think, how can we improve the past CR rate with our neoadjuvant cases? And I think that hopefully we can arrive at combinations. We've seen things like NeoCOAST and other trials. Hopefully we can arrive at combinations that increase our past CR rate without increasing toxicity and precluding surgery. So I think that's an interesting area to keep an eye on.
Excellent. Another study was looking at using artificial intelligence to look at scans of lung cancer prior to starting treatment with immunotherapy and using that artificial intelligence to try to predict the actual response to immunotherapy. I think we're just really getting some really interesting studies with that. Any thoughts on AI and treatment for lung cancer?
Yeah, I think it's coming. There's so much data that we're generating when you combine genomics with all the clinical data and the radiographic data that it's inevitable. It's not an area that that I've been trained in, and I think most of us have been trained in, but there's a lot of research. In fact, there's a researcher at Moffitt, Dr. Anderson, who's looking at mathematical models, telling us when to sort of switch out targeted agents. It's really compelling. It's coming, but you know, probably sooner than we think, but not ready just yet.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank EBI and Stephen for coming down and giving great presentations and talks today. Thank you to Dr. Love and Research to Practice for another great clinical symposium. Anything, Dr. Love?
No, that's it. I was just artificial intelligence. Check out the front page of the New York Times yesterday talking about the Bing artificial intelligence. Sounds a little scary, but anyhow, I guess that's another story. It was a real pleasure to work with you all again. Thank you so much. Have a great day to everybody.
Thank you. Hope to see you next year. Thank you.